ask if there are any questions pertaining to what I was talking about this morning. We might have time towards the end for more far-reaching questions about integration and daily practice and so forth. But if any of the language is difficult or the references weren't clear, what I was talking about this morning, questions or comments, how it felt, felt strange or difficult, dislocating or lovely. You go at your own pace, don't keep up with anybody else. Also, it's see, breath energy isn't quite the same as breathing. It's generally longer than the actual physical respiration. So it's, and sometimes, you know, there may be difficulties with respiration because of certain, you know, constrictions around breathing. It's like nervous or tense. So in a way, just moving your body can help to give that sense of, you know, more, almost like massage. So it's just to be with the movements, let the breathing pick up that theme from the movement. It doesn't quite fit the breathing, but keep the movement nice and smooth and continual, and then that can help some of these unconscious restrictions to relax, and then your breathing begins to extend. You know, so it's almost like, what does it feel like to be breathing out? You know, what does breathing out feel like? What is breathing out? Not the actual physical quality, but what's the emotive quality? Of breathing out, you tune into that sense. What's the emotional quality of breathing? It's take a breath, right, here we go, it's a certain sort of rousing, gathering up. So if you tune into those kind of qualities, that can help your physical breathing to free up a little bit. Of course, when we try to breathe, we mess it all up. You try to get it right, you mess it all up. So you've just got to let it be wrong, But then there's almost like an invitation. This is the kind of feeling quality. So, just it's there, and letting your body find a way to, really breathe out, which it may not know or may not be confident about. Breathing out. It's a very kind of, vulnerable is an evocative word, but it is a very open quality to it, sensitive quality to it. Because when you breathe out, you really let go of everything. So sometimes that isn't always the sign that we feel comfortable with. Breathing in means you actually, you're really going to be present because you're filling up. Sometimes that isn't what we feel comfortable with. We kind of, I don't really know whether I belong here and if that's okay, and am I going to be too, get kind of nervous about that. So, what would it be like to really feel you could just breathe as much as you wanted? know, it's really big. What you feel like, and that's to really let it all go. What do you feel like? You could stand in the middle of a field, in the middle of a desert with nobody else around. You know, just let it flow. Yeah. So you get that kind of mental sense to it. That can sometimes help the body to relax its unconscious restrictions that we can experience. And we know we don't want to, but it just happens that way.
John, I think you are very good at using leading us to do the visual imagination. Like, can you teach us to do some breathing, then yeah, it's really nice.
Imagining it,
yeah. And the shower thing is quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, because we have different forms of intelligence, and I think we sometimes make too much of the rational conceptual intelligence. 5 and 5 equals 10. Yeah. But, you know, when you look at that, what does that feel like? It doesn't feel like anything. You know, 5 and 5 equals 10 doesn't mean anything to me, really. And yet, on one level, that's very, you're adding things up, £5 and £5 equals £10, that's very meaningful. But there's conceptual intelligence, also what we call perceptual, which means that feels kind of comfortable, that feels sort of uneasy to me. You know, that's a felt sense, and that's perceptual. So when you imagine things, you know, what would it be like to feel really like you had a lot of space? Now, that's inviting a particular perception to arise. Like, oh, you know, and you dwell in that. Oh, that would be, yeah. And something actually happens, because that intelligence does feed into your body, into your nervous system. 5 and 5 equals 10. Doesn't do it for me, you know. But 5 bananas and 5 spoons worth of ice cream equals a nice. So it's it's important because that that perception, that perceptual stuff, is part of what we call heart intelligence. So one is just really about brain intelligence. You have the three minds. One is your brain, which is great at very clear, objective, non-feeling distinctions. Black is black, that's white, that's right, that's wrong. That's handy. It's got no feeling to it. So, you know, it has its uses, but there's severe limitations. So in meditation you need to develop that perceptual intelligence as well. You know, why we have things like chanting and shrines and candles and incenses. They're just, you know, on one level, what's this, all this stuff? Doesn't do anything for me, but perceptually it can create a sense of timelessness, sacredness, beauty, grace, softness, gentle harmony. And those are very, very helpful.
When we were doing this, walking meditation, and I thought, what you said earlier of trying to keep it all together, not just focusing on just one thing, or just this step of depression. So trying to do that is sort of at times became almost overwhelming, almost that there was so much to gather together. So there's the sun in my face, and the sounds, and the breeze, and my breathing, and my body posture, and then the steps, or the pressure, or whatever, and at times, you know, the steps sort of went. And it was all, and at some point, it was, so where do I focus on?
Mm.
Because you have a choice.
Mm. Well, yeah, we have what we call boundary problems.
Mm-hmm.
There's no boundary, then it's just, it's cosmic, you know, because there's so much out there.
Yeah.
But proper boundary arises from a good center. So when you center, you know, that creates a proper boundary. Yeah. So I think it's very simple, really. You don't have to go and deal with every issue on the boundary, but you deal with maintaining center. So your boundary is that which is the extent of your awareness which feels comfortable while you still retain the center. So you, if you like, you've got your center and you can extend and widen, but you don't widen beyond the point where you're in touch with your center, you know, because then you know, then you're all at sea, really. It's out there, and the loss of center is a very strong feature for most people, because the center sometimes isn't that clear in the first place, and what there is we lose it because we get caught up in everything that's going on around us, other people, we should be, tomorrow, this, that, this, that. So, you know, you lose center and you're just all over the place, really. Just thrown around by, you know, sense contact or obligations or imperatives of one kind or another. And the real genuine, at home, comfortable, here I am, you know, without any effort. That's the center. So, you know, when you do walking meditation, you know, when we stand, the center is really the upright axis, the sense of, you know, how do I, you know, like almost like a spinal sense, upright sense. When you're breathing, it tends to kind of be more around, you know, the abdomen, you know, because that's where you get, that's where the breath empties, begins in the abdomen. So, you know, center is there. When you're walking, you have the upright sense, and also, you know, the tuning to the each footstep. So that's kind of prioritized, but not exclusive. And so you get the sense of the center that's not kind of held in a defensive way, you know, or got to hold this together. You know, if you keep that centrality in everything, the sensations are coming to you, you know, each sensation lands there, and you keep that center and just kind of soften so that you can allow the stuff to run through, but it isn't catching you, isn't snagging. Does that make sense? Yeah? Help. And again, if it's walking, because, you know, generally when we walk, we're going somewhere. So as you start moving, often the default is to be looking around, where am I going, where am I going to get to? So we're already out. You know, so standing. You know, we begin the walking, we begin with standing. Really stand till you feel that sense of soles of your feet, and the tingling and the warmth in them, as if you're just resting above that, feeling that underneath you. Yeah, and then move from there. One foot is on the ground, feel that the other one lifts and lightens, and then the kind of weight shifts from one side to the other. Yeah, that's your center, this kind of moving center. If it just stand, stop, just loosen your knees a little bit, flex a little bit, so you can really get that feeling of being on your feet again. Okay.
Yep. I wanted just to thank you. As I've said before, it has been real listening to poetry, to listen to you. And also it has been a widening of the awareness range with lots of new nuances. That is, you've given words to feelings I was having and I didn't know the name of.
Mm-hmm.
I live in city. I didn't know all the trembling and the fear and the flutter that you were talking about. So I had desensitized completely a part of me in order to protect. But for example, this morning I was, my awareness on that was quite acute. And to, I noticed that you don't feel protected necessarily on your back, because there are several times you've got runners and you feel somebody galloping behind you, and I feel a sense of fear in that. But mostly the way you've given words to an incredible range of nuances in awareness. Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to recognize that those, that sense of you know, we don't know that we're defended because we're defended from feeling it, because of course it's not very pleasant. But then you can't, your body knows it, and the tendency then can be just to not notice the bits of the body that feel that, you know. But then we're left up in our heads somewhere. You know? So unless you get the body to feel comfortable, you're always going to be basically just chasing thoughts and feelings and emotions. So then if you come, you're sitting, just recognize, like, in front of me right now, you know, is it okay or not? And you say, right now, oh, it feels slightly agitated. So you have to always tell the body or show the body, look, in front of you is okay. You feel that? Yeah, and then behind you, just as if you've got a nice warm fire behind you, or a tree or something, so you feel really, you know, shielded. Yeah. So you get those directions, forward, behind, get them to feel comfortable and safe, and then you'll start to, you know, you, then your body will come into much more relaxed and fully alive mode. And then it will support the meditation. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Anything else?
John, yesterday you were talking about the metta, like the mind being well. I used to do this metta meditation, but recently when I do walking meditation, it seems to be difficult for me to want to think of the sentence as well. Like when I do walking, if I think of my abhiwa, my abhiwa, it seems a bit too much.
Yeah, yeah. Thinking doesn't always do it. Because, you know, may I be well just slide off the top of your brain and becomes another thing you've got to do. So that's where perception is helpful. So what's it like, you know, if you're walking along, just imagine, you know, you kind of, your best friend is coming to meet you. You know, or you're walking along and it's like a kind of a beautiful day on the beach and you're walking along. Yeah. And you get a sense of, and then this realizes it's a sense of which being given to. You know, having the warmth, the openness, the space, the relaxation being given to you. What does that feel like? It's really lovely. And then, you know, as you get to yourself, first of all, my suggestion, because you know, then it loosens, it opens up the heart, comes out of its kind of rather frozen state, and then, you know, then you sort of start to think of the people you respect, fond of, or even people who are suffering, you know, in the sense of, or, you know, may this meet them. But you know, when you walk and you just basically start to tune in to the feeling of being in a an environment that's giving itself to you. Because yeah. that's not just the idea of it, that's the feeling of it.
I think after the retreat, do find the normal scenery, like the clouds and the trees, are looking more prettier.
Yeah. Because we look at non-aversion, you see. So aversion is something I've got to defend myself against, I've got to deal with, and then you're coming to recognizing there's nothing here to have to fend off, there's nothing here I have to fix or deal with, and then things become beautiful. Yeah.
I was wondering about, you know, when you said that our lives are quite, we're living our lives and in a way that rules and regulations and structures are imposed on us either by society or we do it ourselves, but being quite inflexible in our habits, and how meditation should make us more aware of that and then let go also of that need for security which we seek by having all these structures, like you said about your mom yesterday, just the ironing only on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
So, so I was wondering how monastic life or even just even a retreat fits into that in terms of that's actually even more structured than I would say my daily life. And for me that's part of what I like when I go on a retreat, it's more structured, I don't have to think about anything, I know what I'm going to do when I'm going to do it, and I don't have any responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
How does that fit together?
Yeah, well that's scaffolding. So it helps to hold the structure up, you know, before you actually get your own strength, as it were. So you know, it's not as if one doesn't need security. We do need security. The problem is we're looking for it in the wrong place, or we're looking for a place that can't provide it really adequately, you know, or you get it, but you get it at a cost. As you get secure, you also get rigid and metallic, you know. So we're looking for why the word refuge is used in Buddhism. You see, that's a quite a meaningful term, isn't it? Go to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha for refuge. Well, that's about security. Yeah. So we sense the sense really security comes from knowing your centre and being able to stay in your centre. That's what it's about. But then, you know, external structures can help to say, look, don't bother with this, just go to your centre. You don't have to deal with this, go to your centre. This is sorted out, go to your centre. Yeah.
Mm. Can't they also be quite inflexible sometimes? They say, I mean, in monastic life, I would assume, and I've never been
right.
That kind of life, but I would assume it's quite inflexible, you have to.
It's easy to assume things about things you don't know. My lips are sealed about monastic life. Yeah, because there is actually a continuity, and it's a case that certainly, you know, like when you're a toddler, you do need, you know, external supports, and that's the case in monastic training. But then the idea is that what it's trying to do is to keep inculcating a centre. You see, now the body centre, we say, is like breathing in and out, you know, that energy. The mind centre is conscience and compassion. You know, if you ask, you find out that really, you know, the proper, the heart centre, you know, is about conscience and compassion. Because the heart centre is relational. It means, I'm okay, is this alright with you? You know, is that a feeling, you know, wait a minute, I don't know if I really feel comfortable with you. You know, it's that sensing, how are we together? How am I in this environment? How am I in this room? How am I in these people? You know, it's relational. And it can be, how am I in relationship to my thoughts and feelings? It's always that sense. You see, so the centre of it, you know, which is the secure place, is what leaves me no regret in my actions. Yeah. So conscience, this isn't good. I look at certain things come to my mind, and no, I don't want to follow that. I could, you know, feel these, but I don't want to follow it. Because something in me goes, no, that's... Yeah? And it's not just an imposed sense, it's an innate sense.
But would you be able to do that?
Huh?
Would you be able to do that? Not to follow a rule because it doesn't make sense to you?
rules generally are not a problem. You know, at least in monastic life, they're not a problem, unless you get a rule obsessive. You know, but if you get, you know, because they're really an awareness of how we can affect each other, how people can misread each other, how people can accidentally hurt each other, and saying these are the points to watch, these are the areas to watch out for. So rules are not quite what monastic training is about, but it sounds like it. There's about guidelines, about danger signals, about flagging areas, like saying, hey, be careful, you know, about this. And and of course, even then, it's still only you recognise, you know, the mind has, you know, 10,000 inclinations in a day at least. You can't have a rule for every one of them. So you get the basic things about non-violence, non-manipulation, honesty, you know, and you get that, those etched in, you've got the guidelines, you know what those things are pointing to, you know, manipulativeness or scorn or contempt, and think, wait a minute, what does that feel like? Yeah. You know? So once you get that moral sensitivity, then you start to tune into things that you can never really regulate. You can't have a rule for every mind moment. But basically you're starting to get a sense of when is the mind moving into greed, hatred, delusion, you know, spinning out, and what does it feel like? And I don't like the taste of that one. So that's the important thing. Not the rules. I don't want to, you know, put down rules, but what they can induce, if you exercise them properly, they can induce this sense of introspection. Not, you know, again, not introspection that absents the external world, but how's this affecting me? How am I responding to that? Yeah? And you get that, then that sense, that's your guide. That's the centre of the mind, in that sense, in that relational sense. And, you know, it sounds very protective, like, don't do wrong, but the other quality to be encouraged is a sense of compassion, which means, can I bring forth something? And generosity, forgiveness, gratitude, you know, encouragement, you know? So it's not just a don't do, it's also a, you know, it's just, there's something coming out of this. Yeah? You get those two, you find that's your centre on the heart level. Yeah? Understand? And there's various ways, you know, like devotional practices, for example, chanting. They're heart practices. They're about, you know, may I offer, may I feel blessings, may I bless other people. They're just deliberate heart exercises you do. Are on a very much on a perceptual level. You know, you've got, I don't know, a Buddha image or a bodhisattva or some candles, you know, lighting up. You get, you know, it's just a lump of brass and some sticks of wax or muscle, you know, some rational mind. But no, you're actually using those to tune in to the consciousness that can sense, you know, not just me on my own, but sense the other, which could be one person, it could be the whole world. It doesn't really matter, because you're looking at the nerve endings that sense otherness. Yeah? And that, so when it's nerve endings that sense otherness, instead of them being guilty, embarrassed, disinterested, nervous, confused, just you're all right, bring forth the good. But anybody gets it, understands it, notices it, that doesn't count. Just bring forth the good, because it feels good, and you feel this is where I want to be in my life, this is right, this is how I want to live. But whether it affects anybody else, you know, benefits it from or not, we don't know, but this is what we can do. And then, you know, so that conscience and compassion, there's a very, very helpful things to tune into. So then, you know, you can use rules with a little bit of flex, you know. So, as I say, you know, in monastic life, these guidelines, they're not like, you know, they're not punishments. They're like recognizing that wasn't so good. So that's a kind of bit something I wish to acknowledge. That was a bit off, really. And some of them, you really lost it there, you know. You need to actually think very clearly about what you're doing. So there are different gradations of it. And in some cases, you know, you recognise, well, the point of the rule, it would be better to actually, you know, sometimes you just have to step over it because it isn't doing the thing that it's supposed to be doing. It's the wrong occasion. You know, it gets in the way. But those are very minor points by and large.
I just want you to say the consciousness and the compassion. The consciousness you mean like mindfulness, right?
Sorry?
You just said the training of the heart.
Conscience. Yeah, conscience, which moral conscience, which means an ethical concern that what I say or do, how it's affecting you. Yeah. So some sense of concern that you know, you may misunderstand, but I'm going to try and get it right. I don't wish to do anything that's going to upset or abuse you.
Just train ourselves to be more mindful and more sensitive.
Yeah, yeah. But look at cause and effect. Cause and effect.
When you ask the word compassion, then you were earlier talking about how there's the word sort of signals the overwhelm us to some extent, which I agree with, that we can sometimes react by trying to shut some of them out. And I mean, it's not just about things, but about people as well who overwhelm us with maybe their demands. I guess there's quite a fine line to be drawn in how we use compassion. At what level do we use the boundary that you were talking about earlier on, when giving and when you shut the door?
Yeah, that's exactly. It's the same top compassion, because it is very much about sensing the other. You know, so in a way we open to that, and the concern can be that in doing so you lose your center, just get caught up with everybody else, or you know, taken advantage of, you know, or people just suck energy out of you. So, you know, it's got to be a mutual process. That's why it's always to others as to myself in Buddhist training. To others as to myself as to others. So we don't lose ourselves in the equation, in the process. You know? And there can be a sense of, at this time, that's all I have right now. You know, that's as much as I have right now. I can't do any more for you right now. You know, maybe tomorrow, or maybe in 10 minutes' time, but right now, that's you know, I'm flat, the battery's there. But it's not, then it's not kind of like an absolute get out of my life, but it's saying, you know, that there's a limitation of this, you know, and you know, so if we can agree upon a limitation, there's a chance that tomorrow we'll get back together again. And but if we can't, I don't want to be in this. You know what I mean? That's what sort of sense of custodianship of one's own heart. You don't want to lose your centre, because then it's no longer compassion, it's just obligation and assuaging one's sense of guilt, which is what it's about. Yep.
You talked about the body bent and also about the heart bent.
Okay. Three minds. You have one in your belly, one in your heart and one in your head, approximately speaking, because it's an immaterial thing. So the embodied one is fundamentally it's called kaya sankhara, which means the body energy or body formation, which is centered around the breath energy. Yeah? So that's the vitality of the body. Heart energy is centered around compassion, conscience, yeah? Around feelings, perceptions. Yeah? So the wise center of that would be those qualities, the we sense. What we might call the brain or the rationality or the intellect center is discernment. That is its ability to say that's right, that's left, that's green, that's blue. It distinguishes. When you say that's green, that's blue, I'm not saying one's better than the other, I'm just saying they're different. So it just provides differentiation, which again is very, very helpful, because that helps us to locate. You know, this bit is mine, this bit is not mine. You know, so it's clear, and because it's not about feeling, it means it has it doesn't have the same kind of evocative effects that can sometimes be overwhelming. You know, stuff is just so felt so strongly and so intensely, and just whoa, you know, blown away by it or caught up with it or, you know, too much. So the head center is not about feeling; it's about definition. You know, and definition is, see, Buddhist wisdom is not a matter of intellectual knowledge or even sophistry or sophisticated, it's just the ability to discern one thing from another thing. So it's quite simple, really. But you can use it in very sophisticated ways, like, you know, that sensation is like that, that sensation is like that, they're different. You know? You can use it in very sophisticated ways, but it's just the, you know, black, white, left, right kind of system. So its nature is essentially the sense of it not being having a lot of feeling gives it a quality of open space. Yeah, so its fundamental quality is kind of like an open space, because it doesn't have any resonances happening in it. It's just like, and then, you know, so then it's useful, because that's something you can scan your body with that. It's that, that's that, that's that, that's that, that feels like this, that's like that. And then actually, rather than what you imagine, what actually is going on? Because we tend to, you know, we carry around an imagined body. You know, which probably isn't good enough generally. It's too old or too big or too fat or too thin, or so you're carrying around the imagined body. But actually, what really is it? You're going, well, it's a sort of warm and soft bit, and then a sort of sharp and a tingly bit, and a pressure, and a that's a real body. You know. So you know the actual specific, and in, you know, in the next moment it'll be slightly different body, which is good. You get to change it every every now and then. Yeah.
Going back to some of the questions about metta, I find it incredibly difficult to do metta to myself. I find it incredibly easy to do it to others, but I think because of feelings of unworthiness, I find it very difficult to do it myself.
Yeah, loving metta to oneself is generally the sense of unworthiness. It's a pretty standard experience, I would say. We could have a questionnaire as to who's the most unworthy person in the room. Which is, you know, when you realise that, that's rather sad, isn't it? You know, so the, maybe the first sense we recognise is, oh, well, that's really rather, get that, it's rather sad, and oh, so maybe some feeling of tenderness, you know, compassion, just to be living with this all the time. No matter what you do, you can never get rid of that sense. Because it's not about, you know, it's not about, it's not really about action. It's about essence, or to use a long word, ontology. It's about the sense of being. Yeah? Not about, and we try to compensate for being by doing. I'll do this, then I'll feel okay. I'll do this for you, and I'll feel unworthy. Or you'll tell me I'm good. You know. But that doesn't really affect the fundamental sense in which some inner thing is telling me what I am. So that's the thing you're going to work on. So, you know, you can't do it conceptually, because you can add up all the good things you've done and still it won't. So you've got to work on it perceptually, and maybe very almost like, just almost like on a bodily level, because that's a bit clearer than the psychological level. Psychological is infused with a sense of, you know, this is what I am, and you know, this kind of thing. Kind of the body. Well, what's it like to the body to feel relaxed, or to feel warm, or to feel clean, or to feel fed? You know. You get the sense of those things do happen to us. And then just the more you dwell in that feeling of there's an okayness here. Yeah. And then what's it like to have that, to recognise, you know, these things come to us. You know, warmth comes to us, food comes to us, things come to this body. So you begin to, we don't have to deserve it. Which is another false alleyway. And why people have pets, you know, because a lot of our messages about what we are come from confused relationships with other people. Whereas your relationships with your dog is pretty unconfused. Yeah. See, the confusion in relationships with other people comes around with, you know, I want you to be this for me. But you're not. No, you let me down. You know. Because the relationship really isn't about you being something in my world, it's about us meeting in a shared world. And that means we both have to come out a little bit from our meanness to the we-ness. Yeah. So, you know, you can't, me and you doesn't work. We work, but me and you doesn't work. So, the sense in which I'm like this and you're like that, where's the place where we can meet? And for, you know, for unfortunately the one of the things that happens is that I don't want we, I want you. I want you to be an accessory to me. Something I can lean on, something I can lie upon, something to make me feel good. Well, that doesn't work in relationships, because it's not a relationship, it's basically slavery of one kind or another. Yeah. So it takes a lot, you know, because when people lose their centre, then they want someone else to provide it, yeah, which they can't do. So you always let me down. If I ask, you know, in that way. So relationships with other humans can be rather fraught, but that's why you have, well, people have pets, dogs. So just imagine what it's like. You come home, you open the door, and your dog comes and looks at you. And what that feels like. You know, there's a big trusting brown eyes. But for that moment, you're just really it. You know what that feels like. So even your goldfish is probably better. Sometimes, yeah, I've seen a goldfish. He doesn't complain, you know, like you. Why didn't you do this? So just, you know, I can imagine that feeling of when your dog looks at you, you know, oh, and you sort of like capture that little moment and try to, you know, what's it like to be seen in such a way? The dog doesn't ask what you've done today, how much you've earned today, whether you deserve it or not. It just so that's the sense, you know. And so we try to have something like that, being seen. What would it be like to be seen in such a way? What would it be like? Can you feel something in you kind of open up a little bit? You just start with something like that, very simple thing. Well, sometimes children can be like that, babies. They start getting complicated. But it is difficult. The other thing that I find helpful is to work on a sense of gratitude. So generally, I practice it. Last thing at night, I think of any one thing I could feel grateful for. Day. Could be that it was sunny. It could be somebody gave me a biscuit. It could be somebody said, "How are you doing?" You know, something that made you feel for one moment something good was coming your way without you reaching out and grabbing it. You know, is there anything? And just take your time. You know, it could be your own health. It could be something worked. It could be somebody said a pleasant thing. We'll tend to remember the difficult bits, the things we didn't get done, the things that make us anxious. Try to bring to mind one thing which feels like that was really sweet. So you get what it feels like to have that moment of feeling good stuff was coming this way without me demanding it or reaching out for it or deserving it. And then that's metta. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So let's do a little bit of practice.